to the three?
Certainly. The Hartford Institute has been around for about 40, 45 years as part of Hartford Seminary. It began and continues as a place that studies religious organizations, congregations, denominations, more so than, you know, sort of the religious attitudes of individuals.
What is the overview of Hartford research and the scope of work, if you will?
It began in many ways as a social science arm of the seminary to help train clergy and also to better educate missionaries. And it wasn't formally established until the 1980s. As an actual research center, but for almost 100 years, we helped clergy and clergy-to-be to think about the social reality that they were going to be ministering in. And eventually that formalized into the study of congregational dynamics, how they work, and also denominational growth and decline nationally. And that's more or less what we've continued to do, both in support of our doctorate ministry program, but also for the larger world to understand the changes that are happening in our country.
Scott, what would you say is the driving force or was the driving force behind the start of the Religious Research Institute in Hartford?
Yeah, I really think it was to help clergy and religious leaders, lay leaders, better understand how the social dynamics of their congregations and of the denomination have an effect on how they do their ministry. Those of us who teach in the Institute and do research think of the church not just as a theological entity, not just as a spiritual entity, but also as a social reality. And so we use the tools of sociology to think about how those dynamics have shaped congregational life.
Why don't we move into some of the aspects of the research that's being done
Sure. At
the Religious Research Institute in Hartford? The movement of women, first of all, into the role of clergy. What can you tell us about its impact on the church, congregation, and community?
Yeah, certainly that is a pattern that has been observed over the last 30 or 40 years in some denominations and more recently in others. We had for a number of years done studies, especially Adair Loomis, one of our now almost fully retired faculty members, but she was very instrumental along with M.T. Winter and former president of the seminary, BBZ, Barbara Brown Zygmunt. We're kind of tracing the changes that took place in especially the mainline denominations around women's ordination. And, you know, it's pretty clear that still the mainline denominations of United Methodist, Episcopal, Evangelical Lutheran, and other United Church of Christ, those kinds of more moderate and progressive denominations have really opened to female clergy to the point now that many of those denominations have upwards of 40% of their leadership is female. It's hard to say exactly what the dynamics are in the life of the church, in some sense, because even though they have been the position of leadership has opened up to women in those denominations. A lot of the hierarchy still has, in some ways, a kind of male bias. And so what you find occasionally is that female clergy are getting assigned smaller congregations, the weaker congregations, the more rural congregations. And so when you look at some of the data that compares male and female leadership, you see a significant difference, but part of that is because of the assignments that they've been given. I do think that there are changes that do take place in leadership, and sometimes, many times, positive changes that allow for women in leadership. And you're seeing more increasingly in a lot of the non-mainline denominations, more women being open to leadership. We're starting to see more in the Assemblies of God now and some other Pentecostal groups. And also increasingly, one of the trends that I'm watching of late is clergy couples. I study megachurches and have for 30 or 40 years now. And you're increasingly seeing male leadership, but increasingly more like we're a clergy couple. And so the spouse also has a pretty prominent role in leading the life of the congregation.
That's really fascinating. So obviously there is a trend toward allowing more women to be in the leadership position and speak from the pulpit. Can you project what this trend might look like in another 10 years or so?
Yeah. Given the midst of COVID and all of the changes that we're involved in with the pandemic, it's pretty hard to predict anything even for the next year. But I think if trends continue the way they had prior to the pandemic, probably you're going to see an evening out in the mainline, basically a kind of 50-50 split in many of those denominations, and an increased embrace of female clergy in many of the more evangelical traditions as well. And I really do believe that increasingly there's going to be far more clergy couples. And that's partly driven in some sense by the significant growth of non-denominational congregations, another subject that I study quite a bit. Because a lot of the non-denominational congregations are formed around the person of the founder or the leader, and that often are become a clergy couple, and so you'll see many prominent and even smaller non-denominational churches who have a joint leadership of the husband and wife, which is an interesting model in many ways.
Before we go any further, I want to take a look at quickly your ability to communicate the findings that you, how you communicate, and what impact the internet might have.
Yes, I early on in the life of the internet, for some of us older people, right? We watched it become birthed and grew up. I realized almost immediately that it was a great venue for getting the research results that we found directly to religious leaders. And so almost immediately I stopped focusing on writing articles and books and really began to put most of our work on our website. I also reached out to many of my colleagues to put both their research summaries, but also the actual data reports on the web. And consequently, the Hartford Institute website at hartfordinstitute.org has gotten a tremendous amount of traffic. And I think many of the articles and research reports that we put up there get so much more, many more eyes looking at them, and help clergy significantly more than if we saved all those up and put them in a book and published them and charged money for them. I never have enjoyed doing my research and then saying, but the only way you can have the information is if you pay for it. That just doesn't strike me as I think of what I do in many ways as a ministry. I have a master's of divinity and went to seminary, and you know, the idea of keeping that knowledge to myself unless you are willing to pay for it just never made any sense to me. So we use our Facebook page, we have newsletters, and then obviously the website, and several different websites that disseminate what we do, including our Faith Communities Today website and research.
I'm curious, where does your internet traffic come from? In other words, do people request certain types of research? That's part one of the question. Part two is, how are you funded?
Indeed, some people do write to us, a little less so now than over the last 10, 15 years. But still, a week doesn't go by that we don't get asked questions about the religious life in the United States. And so we created a, you know, quick questions, kind of fast facts about American religion, because so many people were asking us, you know, what are the average sizes of churches or things like that. So we respond to that a good bit, but then a lot of traffic we have gotten over the years. People have asked, so how can I look at the social dynamics of my own congregations? And we've had a long history of allowing helping congregations survey their own people. We have a battery of inventories that's a church profile, a pastoral search, and a church planning kind of survey. And we offer those to any congregation that wants them at a flat rate of $300, and they get used 30 to 50 times a year, and now many, many hundreds of congregations have surveyed themselves. So that's actually one of the ways that we sort of fund what we do. But the seminary itself supports the institute and pays my salary and the salary of some of the other folks that work at the institute. And then we also get funded by grants by funders who are willing and interested in understanding better the life of religion in the U.S. And one of those large funders is the Lilly Endowment. They fund a significant amount of religion research in the U.S. And currently we have $1 million grant, and we have a $300,000 grant. The $300,000 grant is to begin to look at how congregations come out of the pandemic, how they begin to adapt. And we're right in the midst of putting together a much larger grant to them that would track congregations around the country for the next 5 years to see how churches are going to adjust their worship, adjust their living together, having come out of this, you know, last year or so of innovation and creativity. And so that's the primary ways that we get funded in what we do.
You mentioned the pandemic. So you are, in other words, you are able to provide some advice or help or restructuring as needed as churches begin to reopen their doors and perhaps other houses of worship as well?
Yes, when the pandemic first began, we at the Institute and also at the seminary began running workshops for people to help them think about how to do live streaming, or you know, how to use Facebook Live, or even just how to better do digital worship. And that came out of our work with our doctorate of ministry students, but we felt like a lot of folks needed to get some of those skills. As we've gone along, we have looked at all of the surveys that are being done, both by denominations, but also by organizations like Lifeway or Pew or others. And we've tried to interpret them, and we do that often in little pieces in our newsletter that comes out through the Faith Communities Today project. But as we get this larger funding grant, we will create some new platforms, and we'll be disseminating the research that we're doing over the next 5 years on a regular basis to really, yeah, help congregations, the lay leadership and clergy think about how to take advantage of the new skills that they've learned during the pandemic. And then also to make that bridge between continuing to be creative, you know, continuing to explore new ways of doing worship, but also at the same time tying back into what clearly many people have lost and felt like, the, you know, having a longing for that fellowship and relationships. So we're committed to trying not just to use our grant research to generate more knowledge, but also to get that helpful information back into the hands of people who are working in the life of congregations.
I'm thinking about the Arabic community. Do you ever get calls to look at the sphere of Arabic faith in any way, or is there any research that covers that?
Yeah, you know, Hartford Seminary, if your listeners aren't familiar with it, is a very different place. It's been around for almost 200 years. And for a very long time, it was a school, it was a school of missions. It had this Kennedy School of Missions that trained missionaries. And eventually, over the last 50 years or so, it became more liberal theologically, but had a long history of looking at Islam and Muslims and Arabic, and eventually created the center, another center at our school called the McDonald Center for the Study of Islam and Muslim Christian Relations. And as such, it began to attract both Muslim clergy, Muslim faculty, but also started a program to train Muslim chaplains. And as such, we have about 30 to 40% of our students are Muslims. And so it's a very interesting kind of interfaith reality. The Muslim faculty mostly train the Muslim students in chaplaincy, but there's also this very, we have many courses of kind of interfaith engagement. So as such, the Institute does occasionally study mosques around the country or the social dynamics of mosque life. But then a lot of our work is in collaboration with another researcher out of Kentucky, Ihsan Bagby, who is the primary person for studying mosques in the U.S. and is about to release some new 2020 material, also through our project called Faith Communities Today.
And in the very few seconds that we have left, gosh, we could really go, we could go a long way with this discussion. It's so informative and fascinating, in my opinion, and I think our listeners will agree. Final question. You've got a couple of research projects. Maybe you could just say what they are. They're in progress right now, realizing that you can't get into any details at this point, but what are you working on?
Sure. Well, I have just completed, along with a colleague, Warren Bird, a new 2020 study of megachurches, and that's available on the Hartford Institute website. And we're going to be doing a few other pieces around that, because we also surveyed congregations of 500 up to 2,000 in attendance, and so we haven't released that material yet. Then I'm just now finishing up a study of non-denominational churches in the U.S. That will be out in the coming months. Likewise, we have this large, over 15,000 congregation study called Faith Communities Today, and we are just—I'm just now in the process of analyzing that data. But I'll give your listeners a tip that no one else has heard yet. What we're finding is that the median size of U.S. congregations, the midpoint, is 65 people in worship, which means that half of the country's congregations are 65 or smaller in size, and half of them are larger. And that number has been going down for the last couple decades, but there's going to be many, many other interesting findings coming out of that. And then we will have this new grant exploring the impact of the pandemic on congregational life coming up in the next couple of years. So it's a busy place right now.
I have to be honest with you. I'm a little shocked at that number, 65 congregants.
Yeah, that's very small, isn't it?
An American House of Worship. That would be a topic for another day, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Scott. This has been enlightening for me, our listeners, and I'm sure I look forward to talking with you again sometime, and you can update us on some of those projects and how they turn out.
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Randy.
Thanks, Scott.